No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
This is Maria Sanchez, and ordinarily I am the co-host with Senator Michael Brown, but he is on vacation, and so he will not be with us this afternoon or evening or whenever you're downloading our program, because we know you can listen live like now. We're Sundays at 4 o'clock Pacific Daylight Time, 7 o'clock Pacific Daylight Time, and or on demand. You can download and listen to us when it's convenient with you. So we thank you so much for making us a part of your life. We know that there are a lot of choices out there, and we consider it an honor and a privilege that you allow us to be one of the choices in your life. And we've got two different guests on the program today. Both happen to be physicians, and our first guest is going to be speaking with us about some of the tragedy and the aftermath of what happens with a massacre such as that occurred last Sunday in Las Vegas. And then our second guest is going to be speaking with us also about hepatitis A. There's a huge outbreak in San Diego and what that means, and the flu shot. Is that something that you should do? Is that something you should consider? Is that something that you'd like more information about? So I'd like to welcome now to the program Dr. John Huber. He's a clinical forensic psychologist, and he's the chair of the nonprofit Mainstream Mental Health. Dr. Huber, welcome to the program, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on, Maria. I'm excited to talk today.
Me too. And I would just like, if you don't mind, giving our listeners an overview of your career thus far. What does a clinical forensic psychologist do? Because people watch those CSI shows, but I wonder how much is reality and how much is imagination.
Okay. Well, I actually started my career as a school psychologist, and because of the litigious nature of academics and public education and special education, I was being drawn into the courtroom a lot. So I decided I needed to go and get some more education, and I went back and got my doctorate degree in clinical forensic psychology. And forensics basically just means it is pertaining to the legal system. So I do a lot of different things, from competency, are you competent to stand trial, to looking at punishment situations for people who may be looking at either the death penalty or life in prison and things like that, all the way to more civil work like child custody issues with divorces and things like that. And to compare it to CSI or that old show in the 90s called Profiler, probably the biggest difference is nothing happens instantaneously. There's a lot of very tedious, boring waiting for things and going through processes. Now, the whole thing where you drop the fingerprints in the computer and they pop up, and you know, before the scene's over, is ridiculous. I mean, I've worked on a case we had over 18 months, and they still had never gotten through the whole data set, and nothing had popped up at that point. So it's slower than what it is.
Reader's Digest condensed version for entertainment.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, a lot of the stuff is valid and truthful as far as the premise behind them, but how they go about doing it is very different. You know, for most DNA labs, it takes, you know, a minimum of 7 to 14 days to get the results back. There are some new DNA tests that only take about 45 minutes to process and get the profile on. The problem with those are they're done in the field and they don't meet the legal requirements to use them in the courtroom, though. So we have to go through and rewrite some of our laws. And instead of having a certified laboratory doing the process, we have to have certified forensic lab techs doing it in the field. And that's going to be a big change.
So my question to you, Dr. Huber, is it sounds like you deal with difficult cases. Is it tough to do what you do in terms of your emotions?
Well, Yes, and in fact, you know, I think you just did a show recently about taking care of yourself, and that's one of that's a very difficult thing in this forensic world, whether you're a detective or a police officer or doing the type of work I do. And one of the things I do is I also maintain a regular practice where I see people who are struggling with regular everyday things, so I can step away from those super tragedy type things where you're looking at death and heinous crimes. And I also provide services at two acute care hospitals where people may be looking at amputation or organ transplants and things like that, and they're struggling with that emotionally. And that those give me opportunities to kind of switch my role so I can
put on a different hat.
Exactly.
So did you have a master's degree and then you went back for your doctorate degree?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Because I've just changed careers too. I talk radio has been my career for decades, but I just got my master's degree in clinical psychology, and now I'm applying to get my doctorate degree in media psychology.
Wow! That's kind of a fascination with me, because this past year I've been in media a lot. So it's like all of a sudden, wow, we need to talk off the air.
So, but what I'm getting from you is that you too decided that you were going to shift gears at some point. And I guess I wanted to share that with our listeners and not let that just go unnoticed, that you decided to make a difference and you decided to change your path somewhat. And you went back and got more education, and now you're doing what you studied to do. And it's never too late. Is, I guess, one of the main things that I like to say.
It's never too late, and I believe we need to continually reinvent ourselves. And as we do that, we will always be growing. And when we stop growing, that's, you know, we start to stagnate and I think wither away.
And then before we get into some of the emotional effects of what happened last week in Las Vegas, let us know a little bit about what mainstream mental health is all about.
Well, doing the things I do, whether it's in the courtroom or in the hospitals, I'm kind of like the lone mental health person. And I go in, I get at the hospital, for example, I get doctor's orders. A doctor writes an order for me to go and evaluate somebody for mental health issues. They don't usually tell me what that is. I just have an order. And as somebody who has privileges at that hospital, I have to follow the doctor's orders. I go in there. And, you know, what I get usually is, I'm not crazy. What are you doing here? You know? And I'm like, well, you've been in the hospital for 3 weeks, and that would make most people depressed. and oh, no. And of course, you know, it's amazing the responses I get. You know, I've had cowboys. I mean, guys who've been on a ranch their whole life, and in 15 minutes, they're bawling and crying in front of me. And I'm like, you know, that's normal for men to cry in front of strangers. That's okay. You don't need me here. And so I'm just kind of going through this process. And, you know, I go into the doctor's lounge area and talk with the other doctors. And I was always, you know, like, wow, there's got to be something we can do. You know, mental health is not a new thing. Why, you know? And finally, you know, got a bunch of the doctors just looked at me and said, hey, you know, you've been complaining about this. Do something about it. So I started a nonprofit organization, and our main goal is to educate, and through education, help destigmatize mental health issues, because we're all affected with them and by them, mm-hmm. whether we have the disorder or not, because somebody we know, a coworker, a family member, has it, and we have to adjust for that. And when it's almost 1 in 4 has a diagnosis in this country, it's prevalent everywhere.
So that's a figure I didn't know, 1 in 4, that's a lot. And then therefore those of us who love them or care about them or are in relationships with them or work with them, that means it pretty much affects all of us.
Every one of us. Now, some of the data says 1 in 5, some of it says 1 in 4. 20-25% of our population has the diagnosis is diagnosable according to the federal government. And then of those people, only 1 in 4 actually gets help.
Wow.
So 2/3 of the people who have a diagnosable disorder struggle forward and just keep moving on in the same path without any help, without any understanding of what's going on. And the fact is, mental health disorders is actually part of being human. It's not abnormal.
It's, you say some things that are so eloquent, and as you said, destigmatize, and thank you for that, because, well, let's start, go back to what happened last Sunday night, and people waking up Monday morning, maybe, let's say, we're got the news, and that's one hell of a way to start a week, and right. In my county, they actually have been profiling those that lived where I live and were killed, and then their families. So we started out the week hearing the stories, the tragedy, the atrocity, mm-hmm. the violence, the massacring of innocent victims, et cetera, et cetera. And I know other people who were affected by it who weren't there, because right. it could have been, or they knew of somebody who, or that sort of thing. And so that's what I wanted to help our listeners, if they're suffering from it somehow, some way. And I don't want to say as much as a PTSD episode, if you will. What can people do when we get this bad news, either passively or actively? How can we put it into context?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, is our whole country is fragile right now. I mean, we started with Harvey, then we go to Irma, then we get Maria, and then we end up with Mandalay Bay. And, I know my office, the numbers for people who want to come in and see me in the next few weeks, it doubled, like literally Monday and Tuesday. I mean, it was just, we got slammed, because it is potentially something that could cause somebody post-traumatic stress disorder, even if they weren't there, because we live vicariously. So many people live their whole life on social media in this country today, especially our millennials. You know, they don't know a world without smartphones. Mm-hmm. And you know, they haven't developed their brain fully. You understand that? I mean, they're in their early 20s, and we usually believe that your brains don't really fully develop until mid to late 20s. So mm-hmm. They're struggling, and they're hurting. And, you know, that group of people already before this happened had the highest attempted suicide rate of any previous generation before. It was a 4-point jump from the next highest group. So they're already struggling socially and emotionally. And I think from some of the other psychologists that I work with in Minnesota and Florida, they've all had increased numbers of people calling to get in. So I think we're all fragile, and any one of us could be affected by that, first of all. So
and then
what do we do about that?
Yeah, because what I noticed is, in my personal case, I lost my father 3 weeks ago, and then the wow. Las Vegas thing, and then he was cremated on Tuesday, and I carried that with me all day. And then on Thursday, there was some terrible, terrible news about a baby in our family that I won't share because it's too private. But I was depressed. I knew it was appropriate. It was situational. It felt right. terrible, but it gave me such a keen appreciation and sensitivity and empathy, if you will, for people who are chronically depressed. What a burden.
Exactly. Exactly. And a lot of these people, they just have never been taught how to be resilient, how to overcome. A lot of people are going to have the beginning feelings or stages of PTSD, and they've learned coping skills, and they know how to move forward, and they will make some adjustments, and they will move forward without any significant slowdown of their everyday functioning and altering any of their normal, you know, relationship issues and things like that. And that's a good sign. But again, I think if we could talk more as a society about mental health issues, we could share what things we do. You know, that was one of the first things. Boy, that's hard doing all those different things with you. Well, one of the things I do is I take time to take care of myself. I do about 6 hours of martial arts every week. And when you have one of those bad weeks, and, you know, I have patients die on me, and it feels really good to go in where I'm learning something in a different language. I have to be quiet and focus on what other people are saying, and I have to move forward and do something physical. Mm-hmm. We're hunter-gatherers. We're used to, biologically, historically, being out walking and about 5 to 9 times a day, spending about 15 to 20 minutes of total exhaustion of energy. If you're chasing down an animal or digging up fruits and, you know, vegetables and things like that. But we don't do that anymore. We sit behind a desk, or we sit in a car and drive. And it's hard for our body to keep functioning that way. So one of the things I recommend to everybody is get outside. Don't just sit around in your normal everyday screenshotting everything, you know, get up and move.
But the problem is, Dr. Huber, you would have to agree, is that when people are depressed, they feel lethargic. They don't have energy. They don't want to go. They don't want to push themselves. They'd rather stay in bed and suck their thumb and be in the fetal position.
Right. It's a catch-22, rock and a hard place. So yeah. Let's do it before we get to that stage.
Yeah. So, again, I think the theme is self-care.
Yes.
And my understanding is prioritizing ourselves first and then letting our life fall in thereafter.
Yeah.
Because if we wait for the time to become, it won't show itself. There's always too much to do.
There's always too much to do, and it's very hard. This week was really hard for me. I mean, Monday with the news, I ended up doing, I think 13 interviews Monday and then two TV spots, and there went my martial arts then. So I ended up having to double up, and it's hard to – I had to, though, because I would go nuts.
Yeah. So let's talk about people who might not know that they are as affected as they are, especially, like you say, because what one of my millennial friends was telling me is she can't stop hearing the rounds going off. Now, I didn't listen to that because I want to choose not to expose myself to that. But some people couldn't help themselves, or it happened accidentally in the background or what have you. So I don't know if you would call that secondary trauma. But in any event, it's obviously had an effect on folks. And what can they do about that?
Well, you know, and it's funny you say that, because one of the signs of PTSD is reliving the event, and hearing those rounds going off is part of that. So this is somebody who is starting down that road of post-traumatic stress disorder, even secondary or primary. You know, if they actually sat there in the concert and heard, I think that would be primary. Everything else, I think, would be secondary. Mm-hmm. But it's still very real. And the next thing that typically happens is they start avoiding things that might cause them, you know, something that might trigger those memories to come back again. So they may not go to concerts. I mean, this week in Austin, we had the ACL, Austin City Limits Festival, and people sold their tickets back. It's been sold out for months, and they sold their tickets back because they didn't want to be in a large crowd like that.
I was thinking that exact thing, because as I mentioned to you before we are on the program, my daughter has been in Austin for 24 hours, and she was mentioning she was out last night as the concert ended and the football game ended. So she said Austin was trashed. Everybody was just out of
it. Yeah, I was in that crowd. We had a family from out of town, so we were in that traffic and everything, and it was pretty crazy. Were experiencing trauma, that would definitely be a trigger for it.
So is the advice that you would share that you should go about as much as possible being as, quote, normal as you have been in terms of routines and schedules and commitments?
Definitely, I would do that. Second thing I would do is tell your story. And I don't mean on social media. I mean, go find a human being that you care about and that cares about you. Go sit down, have a cup of coffee, have an iced tea, go have dinner with them, and tell your story. Talk, each of you, exchange the trauma that you experienced. Let somebody else hear your story. That's one of the resilient defenses we can put up to help fight off things like post-traumatic stress disorder and to get through things like depression that's stimulated by this type of trauma.
So when you say tell your story, which is another eloquent saying that you have, you don't necessarily mean that it has to be in a therapeutic alliance, i.e. No. with a professional. It can just be with somebody who you care about and vice versa.
Somebody that it means something to. I mean, you may say, well, I got 3,000 friends on Facebook. And I'm like, okay, so which one's going to come here and make you chicken soup when you're sick? It's very saccharine sweet. They still give you that little endorphin pump that you, when you see your friends and they smile at you, by liking something, you get the same, we've measured it, you get a neurological bump of dopamine every time. So it becomes very reinforcing, but there's no nutrition there, no psychological nutrition in that. So it's empty calories.
Is it because you're articulating your thoughts and giving them words that is helpful, or is it the bonding that happens with sharing?
I think you hit on both of them, and that may be your training, but I think it's both of those. I think by processing your experiences, you take power and control away from them, and you're able to work through and put them in a perspective. You know, it was a week ago. It wasn't today. You know, you survived it. Do you feel guilty about that? You might. Process that. Why would you feel guilty about that? With a friend, you don't need a therapist at this point. Now, if you find yourself trapped in, I can't do this, I can't do that, I'm going to have to quit my job because that puts me around too many people, you need to go see professional help. You know, if you start having a functional decline, whether it's in your relationships, your family, your friends, or your work, or with a lot of my friends and stuff that are in college and graduate school, if all of a sudden you find it very difficult to walk into that school building, that university classroom, go get help, because you're just going to delay the inevitable, and it will be worse and worse and worse until you get more coping skills and strategies in place.
And again, a fantastic example about destigmatizing. It's not bad to need help. It's not wrong to seek help. In fact, it mitigates what might happen if you don't get the help.
Exactly. In fact, I recommend that even people who think everything is going great, that you go and visit a therapist once a year. And there's a reason for that. First of all, it kind of grounds you, and you can kind of bounce things off of them. But it also gives you somebody, because if you are somebody that is very resilient and friends and family come to you all the time, sometimes they come to you and you just don't know what to do and you think they need professional help. You can go, hey, I've got a person I know. I've actually talked with this person. It's not just somebody I pulled out of the phone book.
Mm-hmm.
And this person's good. They're a nice person. You can trust them. They make you feel comfortable. Whatever your experience is with this person, now you have another resource that makes you even more resilient and more able to help people in your community, family, and friends.
So what can we do to help with the destigmatization of mental health? How can we... Because our next guest is going to talk to us about the Hep A and what's going on in San Diego. And by and large, it's with the homeless population. And I'm sure you would agree that by and large, there's usually mental health challenges in that community.
Oh,
and so it's almost like both of you are going to dovetail into the same theme, which is mental health.
Exactly. And, you know, I've taught at Texas State University until this summer when my nonprofit is just kind of snowballing and I had to give something up. And I'm reaching a lot of people with my nonprofit. So my wife, you know, we talked and sort of stepped away from the university. But one of the things I did with my students is I encouraged them to go and volunteer at their state hospitals. And I give them, extra credit for a semester. I've got students who still are in touch with me who started volunteering in 2005, and they still volunteer now that they've gone. They've got jobs that are not related at all to mental health, but they still go in there and they volunteer, you know, 5-10 hours a month, whatever, at the state hospital. And that, I mean, it's kind of like when you realize that any of those people in there could be you if all the dominoes lined up just right. If all the stressors fell and the support disappeared that you have and all this kind of stuff, you could be right there. And that's an important thing to remember. Those people on the street, they didn't, you know, get up when they were in fifth grade and go, hey, you know what I want to do for a living is I want to be homeless and I want to suffer from hallucinations and delusions and not be able to maintain a job and personal hygiene. And, you know, they didn't start that way. You know, and they didn't have the ability or the support or the coping strategies and skills. And once you realize that it is a human condition, they're not there because of something they chose to be there. You know, I mean, it's mental health issues affect everybody almost haphazardly. There's some genetic correlations, but there's also a lot of that diathesis stress model where the environment can push a lot of buttons and trigger things. And, you know, somebody may have never had a family history of any kind of psychosis, and all of a sudden somebody's got it in their family. What triggers that? It's not all genetic. So,
and whether or not innately we have the nature nurture, and if we have the ability to cope, because some people don't have that within them, and it isn't a defect. It just means that they're just not able to deal with the stressors that someone who can cope is able to do.
And, you know, were you taught that? Maybe you had parents who were blessed with somebody who taught them how to deal with stress, and now you've got a friend who didn't have that support, didn't have somebody who knew how. And maybe it's because they never had any kind of stress. People who live sheltered lives because of, you know, their family has money and things like that. You put them in a real-life situation, and they can't cope because they never had to struggle through that. There are some middle-class people who have that same situation. We've tried to protect our kids so much. You know, we've done non-compete sports because we don't want to stress our kids.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're human beings, and the reality of it is we need to experience that stress, and we need to have somebody to coach us through that stress before it becomes basically a life-or-death kind of situation as an adult, where if you're not functioning, you don't have a job, and you can't afford to feed your family and things like that.
And also, it, like you said, if you can learn to do that in little increments, that's a lot easier than suddenly one day, like, boom, here you go, and that you've got a life-changing challenge, and you don't know what to do because you never were given any tools along the way.
Exactly. And, you know, I, as a school psychologist, I saw it a lot. And so, you know, you can ask my children, when they're in the lower grades, they have conflicts with their teachers, and I'm like, you know, you need to learn to cope with that. Of course, we would have conversations with the teachers behind the scenes, let them struggle with it, and if my child failed, we were there to help them and teach them how to overcome that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's given them advantages as they've gotten older and are moving into high school and things like that, that some of their friends don't have.
Well, I used to say to mine when we had dinner together every night, and I'll never forget, my eldest came home one day and he was saying, "Mom, do you know that people don't have dinner together every night?" And I was like, "Oh, you're kidding." And he goes, "No, I tell my friends and they can't believe it." And I was like playing devil's advocate. Oh my gosh, how can that be? But that's where so much of the information comes out. And they, when they would talk about having a challenge with one of their teachers, I always ask the question, "Do you want me to get involved?" And almost every time they would say, "No, I can take care of this myself." And I was like, "Great, just checking." And it, by and large, they did. I hardly had to. I have four children. I hardly ever had to get involved with the schools because they figured it out somehow. But they knew they had my support. And I didn't micromanage, and I didn't hover, and I didn't helicopter, and all that stuff that a lot of my peers have done, writing their essays for college acceptance.
That's interesting, because I have my kids who brought us in because of friends. They're like, "This is going on with my friend over here, and why don't you see if you can help them?"
Aww.
And we start with the parents, and then, and you know, my wife and I are very involved, and elementary school especially, but then into middle school, and now we're seeing it somewhat in high school, where we're being a support foundation for some of the kids and their parents that are friends of my children.
That's nice.
By recommendation of the school. You know, teachers say, "Why don't you go talk to these people? They've done this, and they've gone through stuff like this."
And you're being a village.
Yes.
Yeah, at its finest.
Well, nothing's in isolation.
Yeah. So, Dr. Hubert, before we run out of time, I'd like you to give contact information for folks to get in touch with you or to learn more about what it is that you do, or et cetera.
Well, and we're at mainstreammentalhealth.org, and we have, you know, at the bottom of the page, we have all our Facebook and our Twitter and Instagram, and we're out there in the media in different markets and trying to help destigmatize. And right now we're starting a new campaign where we would like to create a fund for our veterans to get outpatient therapy. Because right now a veteran wants to go to the VA and get a therapist, it's on average nationwide 132 days to get to see a therapist.
Oh.
Since I've started this, I've gotten contacted by some veterans in Georgia, and one of them said it was 13 months before he got in to see his therapist.
That's terrible.
So, and we're losing 22 a day to suicide. And, you know, just to get the website and the mechanism in place, we're looking at about $300,000. We need to get that started. And then to make an impact, we're talking tens of millions of dollars to start making that off. But we're starting one step at a time. You know, that's all we can do. And if you want to help, there's lots of places on there. If you buy at Amazon, go to our page and there's an Amazon button, and everything you buy will get a percentage of donation from Amazon.
Is that an adjunct to Mainstream Mental Health, or are you putting a different name on it?
No, you just go through mainstreammentalhealth.org, and then it'll go through Amazon smile.amazon.com. Mm-hmm. It automatically puts you there. And if you have already discounts or Amazon Prime, that's all. It'll all be there. And you still get all of that. And what it is Amazon just gives us a half a percentage point off their profit, and they just give it to us as a donation.
Great.
It doesn't affect the cost or anything else that you do. So it's a real simple way, and it doesn't take anything out of you. Just you're telling Amazon to donate to us.
So. Nice. Thank you so much for your time. I look forward to having a relationship with you moving forward, whatever that looks like.
Definitely. And I'd love to talk with you some more, especially about the media psychology you're doing.
Sure. I look forward to that. Dr. John Huber, Clinical Forensic Psychology, MainstreamMentalHealth.org. Thank you for your time. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to play a Tom Petty song in honor of Tom's passing, and then we have Dr. John Horton as our next guest. Thank you for listening to Shadow Politics.
Well, I started out down a dirty road. Started out all alone. And the sun went down as I crossed the hill. And the town lit up. The world gets still. I'm learning to fly, but I ain't got wings. Coming down.
This is Maria Sanchez with BBS Radio and Shadow Politics. Our host is Senator Michael Brown. He's on vacation, so I'm flying solo today and enjoying the privilege and the opportunity. I want to thank you so much for allowing us to be a part of your lives. And just want to thank Dr. John Huber, who was our guest the previous part of the program, a clinical forensic psychologist. And now we have Dr. John Horton as our guest. He is with World Travelers Healthcare. He is a physician. He also is an author. He wrote the book, The Inner Game of Stress, Outsmart Life's Challenges and Fulfill Your Potential. And Dr. Horton and I have been together professionally. He was my medical correspondent on my terrestrial radio program. So we have a nice little history between the two of us. So thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Horton. Appreciate your time and your wisdom, as always.
Welcome. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Sure. Yeah. So before I want to talk with you a little bit about hepatitis A and what's going on in San Diego and how we may not be in San Diego, but we might be able to avail ourselves of what is coming out of that situation, as well as the flu shot, if that's something that you will weigh in on. But let's talk a little bit about your book, The Inner Game of Stress, because you talk about the wisdom system there, and I think that's of value to our listeners.
Yeah. Well, the wisdom system is a system. It's a biological system like any other system in our body, like the cardiovascular system or the respiratory system, or let's take the example of the immune system. We didn't know about the immune system 150 years ago. It still existed, and of course it's essential to our survival. It's what takes care of killing infections like hepatitis A and other infections. We didn't know about it, so we didn't know how to support it. Now we know how to support it, so you can get an immunization, a little particle of the hepatitis A virus that alerts your immune system. It creates a defense, so if you do see that virus, then you can kill it. We have many immunizations that have improved our health. So let's talk a moment about how stress, chronic stress, opens the door to illness. I think we're all aware of that. I don't think it needs a whole lot of explanation to an intelligent audience. But what is it that's going to counter the stress system? Because if that system just is on go all the time, and it's how we respond to physical dangers and physical frustrations and pain and those three things, fear, pain, and frustration, which are abundant, but most of them don't have to do with our physical survival. Stress system does have to do with our physical survival. So it has a very small menu we all know about, fight, flight. There's also a freeze reaction. We could literally hide in a cave in Africa for 3 days without food or water if there was a big animal. So sometimes when we're hurt or we're afraid, we freeze. We just shut down, crawl under the covers and don't come out. And then there's a herd behavior. So my friend Owen Plan called it flocking. When we're in danger, we tend to herd together and have a big, strong leader out front. And this is this can be the worst of politics and religion, where we lose our individuality and hide in the herd for safety and numbers. But our problems don't have to do with physical survival most of the time. They have much more to do with our need to evolve our lives, and the fears and the frustrations, pains, are due to our lack of satisfaction, our lack of contentment. So what if there was a system, and this is what some of us are calling a wisdom system, that needs to be understood on par with the immune system, the stress system, respiratory system, which is a system that allows us to reach a human dynamic of contentment. And that's a system that I'm extremely interested in, as are a number of other people.
So, great.
That was a mouthful, huh?
Yes, but I'm really glad that you related it to something that we all know and accept, our immune system, our respiratory system. So you're suggesting that the wisdom system is there, that we probably, most of us, never really knew about it. But so let's not go into is it there or not, but how does one tap into the wisdom system? Because then that would be a universal experience that we all have.
Absolutely. So think about it. When you feel like you're really getting stressed and you feel like you're entering into a realm of confusion or doubt or emotional pain, the best thing you can do is to step back from what's going on and see it clearly. This is called reflection. This is the essence of mindfulness. I think it's the essence of prayer, actually. That you step back and you see, okay, yeah, I feel really afraid because, oh my God, I think my job is ending. I can see all the signals. The politics are there. I don't have a clue what kind of job I can get. Oh my God. Now I can start running around, or I can start drinking, or I can shut down, or I could step back again and say, okay, so now I know why I'm fearful. The minute I accept that, here comes a different menu. Here comes a menu of reasoning. Here comes a menu of communication. Here comes a menu of empathy. Here comes a menu of the qualities of the human heart, my innate courage, my innate peacefulness, the ability to love. These are treasures that are built into us that we could label as the wisdom system. So the key thing is to be able to step back and reflect.
But it also, it does make sense, but it requires awareness.
Absolutely. That is the first and foremost way of connecting with the wisdom system, is awareness, consciousness.
So that means that in this busy world of ours, the multitasking, always going, 24/7 news cycling, social media madness that many of us live, we have to take time, I would imagine, to disconnect and to step back, as you said, and to pause.
And to be able to connect with ourselves. You know, it's always been said that self-knowledge, that the qualities of our core humanness, are our most profound and important resource. So exactly, we need to step back and connect with ourselves. And gain. And I'm not talking about self-knowledge like People say, oh, self-knowledge. Well, I'm a beer person, not a wine person. Or I like men. But sometimes I like women. Sometimes I like... That's me. No, those are your consumption habits or your desires or your, you know, worldly identities. We're talking about what you observe in small children, their ability to have such a beautiful sense of contentment and such a beautiful tranquility just within themselves. So that's still there.
If somebody doesn't know what that looks like or how to tap into it because we have been trained to be distracted, what and how do you begin?
I think you put it right. We've been trained to be distracted. So we have to see, who do I want to train me?
Yeah.
The distractors, which are all over the place.
Uh-huh.
The shrill voices of consumerism, the shrill voices of politics, or do I want to be entrained? Do I want to be aware of those qualities of the self which I can enjoy, which gives me the courage and the strength to move ahead and become my own source of fulfillment?
Because I'm wondering too, how might philanthropy help in that regard? Because that's other-centered.
But it's an expression. Look, if I can't be a philanthropist if I don't have any resources, okay?
Right.
Whether they're physical resources or inner resources. So I've got to evolve my own resources, okay? Then it's wonderful to express them. My friend Tim Galway, who's the co-author of The Inner Game of Stress, at a seminar recently said, it's interesting because my outer resources, the more I spend them, the less I have. I mean, if I have $2 million and I spend, you know, $1.5 million, I only got $500,000 left. I don't have that kind of money. I wish I did, but get the example.
I was going to say, yeah.
But the inner resources, my ability to love, my ability to understand, to have empathy, to help, interesting, the more I express that, the more abundant it becomes within me. So there you
now,
have
that's
it.
Something there. I've never heard before.
No, I hadn't.
In other words, not only is it replenishable, but it actually is multipliable?
Right. So, look, I can tell you, and you know this too. I mean, you're doing psychology now. There are days that I'm seeing patients, and I can tell you that there's a part of me that just wants to go home and lie under the covers because I'm freaked out by this, that, or the other thing. But there is someone in front of me. They have a problem. I have the training. I have the experience, I have the skill, I start to help them, I see they're getting help. It's like, wow, that gets me out of that inner funk.
Mm-hmm.
So the part of the wisdom system is our ability to have empathy, to have compassion, to have kindness, to help other people.
I think that's fantastic. That's so, because you're right, it's... like my mom always says too, like happiness shared is doubled, sorrow shared is halved, so that we can, by helping others, we not only are helping that situation or that person or that challenge or what have you, that cause, but we're helping ourselves too.
Exactly. I mean, this is where the harmony, the more I'm in harmony with the wisdom system within me, then the more I can connect to the wisdom system in another person. And that's the best of the other person. You're right. I mean, sorrow, I mean, it seems like this is part of our distraction, is that we think that we should express our sorrow as well as possible to as many people as possible, which is not really very useful.
Right. So let's shift, because it's a kind of on the same lines, in that this hepatitis A, if people don't live in Southern California as we do, they might not know what's going on. So maybe you could just share a little bit about what is hepatitis A. And then two, it's mostly an issue with the homeless population. And obviously we know that their challenge oftentimes is mental health or the lack thereof. And
no, this
again,
has nothing to do with mental health. Hepatitis A is a virus, just like the flu. You know, we're coming up on flu season, which, by the way, I do think that flu shots are worthwhile. Try and get them without mercury. That's the ones that we have in our office. So it's a viral infection. How do you get the flu? Someone has the flu. This virus is replicating in their system. Viruses are just little particles of RNA or DNA. and it's replicating, and then you cough, and it goes out into the air in a droplet, and that droplet goes into another person's nose because they're breathing, and the droplets, you can't see them. And now that virus can start to replicate in that person. So you get a flu shot so that you give the body a heads up. It's like, okay, this is what's coming, so there's already an immune system response. So when the virus comes in, the immune system can nail it. So basically, if you get a flu shot, either you don't get the flu so easily or not at all, or if you do get the flu, it's not as nasty as it would be if you didn't have any immunity. So hepatitis A is a virus. It's common throughout the world. When you come to our tribal medicine clinic, which is part of what we do besides general practice and psychotherapy, if you're going to some parts of the world, we'll give you a hepatitis A immunization. And children are getting hepatitis A as part of their usual immunizations these days. The way that virus is spread, it's the fecal-oral route. If someone has hepatitis A, they shed the viruses in their feces, their poo-poo. So people get hepatitis A because someone who has hepatitis A is not very clean when they're wiping their butt after taking a shit, or there's, you know, food or water that's been contaminated. And every once in a while, you know, you get a little hepatitis A thing coming out of a restaurant because someone in the restaurant had hepatitis A, and it spreads rather easily. So when you think about the homeless population, you're talking about poor sanitation.
Right. And that, and why I said mental health is because the homeless population tends to be challenged with mental health issues, thus the homelessness.
In part. Right. But I would argue with that because I've seen this over many decades. Is that, when I was a consultant at the Venice Family Clinic, not everyone that was homeless was mentally ill. A lot of people had fallen through the cracks of our poor infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. And so if somebody's listening to this program and they're thinking, hepatitis A, should I get the immunization? Do you suggest that? Or
Well, when you get the symptoms, it's a little bit late. You've got the illness. It's like waiting to get your flu shot until you have the flu.
Okay.
I think if people are concerned, it's a very available immunization. It's a very effective immunization. We're giving it all the time for travelers. I think if someone is concerned, why not get it?
And
I wouldn't say that, you know, every adult that hasn't been immunized should go out and get immunized against hepatitis A. I don't think that's reasonable.
Okay. And why is travel an issue?
Because the sanitation can be poor. Poorer than the United States in some parts of the world.
And so do you immunize depending on where they're traveling to?
Exactly.
Or just in general that they're outside the United States?
No, if someone's going to Europe or they're going to Japan or going, you know, but if they're going to, you know, less developed countries where the sanitation might not be as good, then yeah.
Because I don't recall, but I saw you when I traveled to Senegal and I had to do a series of shots. Like,
yeah.
We started at months in advance of my departure, it seemed. And then there was follow-up, too. Boosters or something.
Yeah, you would have gotten hepatitis A for that.
Okay. And then let's talk briefly about the flu shot, because this without mercury comment that you made, that's news to me.
Yeah, I mean, a small part of the population is sensitive to mercury and shots. And you don't know if you're part of that, so why not get a shot that doesn't have mercury? That's our conviction in our clinic. That's why our flu shots don't have mercury.
Now, does somebody, if they're not in Southern California and can't avail themselves of your clinic, is that something that a Rite Aid or a CVS would share with the consumer, whether it does or doesn't have mercury?
Sure, you could ask them. And look, I don't say it's. I mean, I got flu shots for years that had mercury, and it never bothered me. So I don't think it's a small amount of the population that would be bothered, but you could certainly find out.
Because that's a question that I wouldn't have known to ask.
Yeah, it's not a critical question. It's more a question of some people know they're sensitive or they feel they're sensitive, and most most of us aren't. So I don't think, you know, that if you want a flu shot and all that's available is ones with mercury, I still think that it's reasonable to get a flu shot.
Now, I've also heard people say that they got the flu from the flu shot. And can you dispel that myth?
It's dispelled.
So look,
it's not a live virus. It's not a live virus.
Right.
I mean, this happens all the time. People tell me that, well, I got the flu shot and then I got the flu. Now, the flu is a particular virus, influenza A or influenza B. These are particular viruses that come at a particular time of the year, winter, and they are very contagious and they can be very nasty. But throughout the year and also in the winter, there's all kinds of viruses. Mm-hmm. So people come into my office, oh, doc, I got the flu. You have a viral infection. It's probably not influenza A or influenza B. It's a viral. It can also be nasty or not. You see what I'm saying? So
Yes. Every
viral infection, every time you have a cold and you're sneezing and you're coughing and your body aches, it's not necessarily the flu. So I think sometimes people get a shot and then later and they get a viral infection, not from the shot, and then they say, oh, I got the flu.
And what about the one that they used to offer, and I don't know if they still do, in the nose?
Yeah, I've never thought that was particularly a good idea, and I don't know that it's very, much available or popular these days. I think it was an experiment that probably wasn't so successful.
I know that locally they're telling us here in Southern California to get the shot and not the nose. But I didn't know if that was a World Health Organization thing or if that's just a Southern California thing or what have you. So I wanted to let the listeners know, because depending on where they are in the country, the status quo might be different.
It's a good question. I don't exactly know the answer.
Okay, so that's something for other folks to figure out too, which is also what I like about our conversations, is that it's very important to be proactive and to be your own advocate and to get the information that you should have, which I'm glad you brought this mercury thing up. And I understand that it's a small portion of the population that may have an adverse effect to it. But as long as you know now that we shared with the listeners that we know that that conversation can occur, then you're making a more informed decision if you choose to have it or not in your flu shot.
This being proactive, this is very good. I have patients that come and they say, doc, I like to research things on the internet. You probably don't like that. And I go, no, let's make a distinction. I don't think the internet is a good place to go for a diagnosis. If you have chest pain or abdominal pain, you're not going to find something that says, well, maybe you ate some food that upset your stomach or you're a little bit uptight. You're going to find out about, stomach cancers and heart attacks and serious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, if you have a question, like you have a particular illness or you want to find out about flu shots and, what's the difference between the mercury or the non-mercury and what about the nasal one, it's all there. I mean, you could Google it. You could ask Siri to look it up for you, and
mm-hmm.
and there it is. And you have the latest information from all kinds of resources. So I'm totally into people being proactive and doing medical research on things they know about, but not diagnostically, because in the middle of the night, stomach ache, you're going to end up, wondering if you have cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Not what you want to be doing in the middle of the night.
Mm-mm. And personally, since I deal with cancer patients on a daily basis in the psychosocial therapeutic way, I don't know how people don't become hypochondriacs.
Yeah.
Because I've talked with so many of our folks that a simple headache turned out to be brain cancer, or a backache turned out to be cancer in the spine, and things that we all experience, and you just kind of go, huh, oh well, and then they found out that this or that or the other. So there's got to be a fine balance between always running to
I'll tell you the critical variable, because I've done counseling with serious hypochondriacal people. And what I teach them is, how do you know whether a symptom is really worthy of a lot of attention or not? And the main thing is it continuing and is it getting worse? Because if you've got a If I sprain my back, yeah, it hurts, and I can probably tell you when it happened. And then I do some stuff, and it starts to feel better, and you know, maybe I tweak it again, but I'm on top of it. I know where it's at. But I have this deep pain in my back, and it just keeps growing and growing because cancers are growing, and they're going to impinge, and they're going to cause symptoms. So it's the symptoms that continue, and you don't have a good reason for them. And they don't respond to the things that would just help it if it was a little functional problem. Those are the situations where you need to pay attention. And that's where people go to the doctor and go, well, it's probably just, you know, a back sprain. And you have to be proactive. Wait, no, this is not a back sprain. I know what a back sprain is. This is something more. I want an x-ray. I want an x-ray. Hello, I want an x-ray. Give me an x-ray.
That was terrific that you how you said, because when I hear our participants' stories and I think, geez, how many times has that happened to somebody? And then you just kind of shrug your shoulders or you figure, oh, whatever, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then I hear what ends up happening, because, of course, I know that the population that I'm serving is a small fraction of our world. But nevertheless, that's what I'm familiar with. So I like what you said, is that if it's not getting better, if it's not succumbing to the normal RX, if you will, then, yeah, let's maybe look a little deeper here.
Yeah, so maybe this is my question now I ask my patients. It's my new question. It's a multiple choice question, and I'll give it to you. Is the human body, is the human body a user-friendly system? A, yes. B, no. Choose one.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So if it's a user-friendly system, which I agree, then hey, it's going to tell you something's wrong. Pay attention. This is not right. This pain in my stomach, it doesn't come and go. It's not based upon whether I'm drinking coffee or eating, you know, chilies. It's like I've never had this before, and I feel nauseous every morning. I never feel nauseous. You got to investigate that.
Right. That's great advice. What a great way for us to end our conversation. Dr. John Horton, do you want to share anything else? Contact information, website, the inner game of stress, Outsmart Life's Challenges?
Let me say something about the inner game of stress. The inner game of stress was a collaboration between myself, my medical partner at Hanslick, and Tim Galway, who's, you know, an extremely well-known, one of the father of modern coaching, if you ask Bradley, the quarterback, who was the most influential people in your game? Oh, Tim Galway, the inner game of stress. I mean, the inner game of tennis and golf.
Tennis, so, right.
The learning theory of the inner game is very powerful. This book was supposed to be a nationwide bestseller, but our friends at Random House bought another book on stress and then dumped our book. So it never got the publicity, it never got the attention, and so it just languishes. Or hopefully someday we could get Random House to give up their rights, and we could publish it and put in a new chapter about the wisdom system and put it out as a paper book and paperback, and it would be highly successful.
Well, from your mouth to God's ear, let's hope that happens. So we can get the word out. Thank you, Dr. Horton, as always, for being a guest on the program. Really
My
appreciate
pleasure.
Your
Thank
wisdom.
Thank you for having me.
You. You're welcome. You take good care. And this is Maria Sanchez on behalf of Senator Michael D. Brown saying thank you for listening. Hope you have a wonderful week. We hope that we have provided you with some information. And feel free to contact us if you'd like us to explore other topics or subjects. And thank you to BBS Radio for the opportunity for Shadow Politics.
Give the people their right to vote.